because I am not always perfectly related to God. But let me give you a little bit of how this sometimes plays out in verse 20 there. When Rob and I, we were walking around the block one night this week, and we were just commenting on how God was so good to us when just the way the economy has worked. When Eric went through college, I was working a paper route in the morning, and Eric had a paper route. We were working and saving some money, and we could kind of get him through by himself. That wasn't such a big deal. Bob Jones had kind of a special where they had dropped the tuition a little bit. It wasn't too bad. The second year wasn't too bad. But when Stephanie started, now kids in college, and now we're, I don't know, on what the $15,000 a year times two, it got to be pretty spendy. So we went down to our bank, and this is again back, I don't know how many years, Stephanie's been out a year, so 5 years ago or so, we go down to the bank, and the economics weren't all that great at that time for us, and we went into the bank, and we got a home equity loan. And there's all kinds of different ways that we could do the home equity loan, and one of the things that we did was we just took a line of credit against the house. But we didn't want a very large line of credit because, you know, who wants to have a large line of credit? Well, the gal there says, you know, your house is worth so much, and if you get a crazy amount of line of credit, then we would allow you to have your interest rate would be prime minus 1%. And we thought, okay, that might work. Well, the rest of the story doesn't need to be played out because you know what interest rates are, and ours is 1% less than that. So it's just amazing how just God does some of these little things insignificant. We already had, we kind of figured it out, and we needed, you know, X amounts of thousands of dollars to put Stephanie and Eric through school. And we went to the bank, and the bank says, no, don't do that. Get gazillions of more dollars that you could, and then we can drop your percent. Oh, man, that's been sweet, and it's been a variable. So, you know, when everyone was hurting, you know, in the last couple of years and interest rates are still lower, it fluctuated, ours just keeps going lower and lower. So now, again, I'm not trying to say that God's going to do that for you, and I'm not saying that I'm perfectly related, but that is some ways that God is able to do exceedingly abundantly above all that we could have ever asked or thought, because I think that I probably have probably one of the lowest school loans around. Well, it's a home equity loan, but you know what I'm saying. And God has just done so many things like that in our life that when we look at some of these questions, it's not just to put a dump a guilt trip on you. It's to be a lens. It's to be a light. It's to be an opportunity whereby we can investigate our lives and see, do you love me? Remember, do you love me? And Peter says, no, God, I do not agape you. I phileo you. Peter, do you love me? I don't love you. Agape, that sacrificial love. I philos, Philadelphia, brotherly love you. And then finally Jesus says, okay, I'll take Philadelphia love, and I'll go out there and feed, take care of my sheep, tend my lambs, etc. And then we have the disciples in the boat, and they have just seen a spectacular demonstration of God's power as we look through the first few chapters of the Gospel of Luke. And again, they're seeing all these great things that Jesus is doing, and he's asleep in the boat, and the storm comes up, and after he calms and he rebukes the wind and the waves, they settle down, then he kind of rebukes the disciples and says, where is your faith? And you and I, we need to be asking ourselves, where is the faith? And equally more important, why is it that we're so quick to forget all the miraculous things of God, and then in that brief moment of time when the storms of life come, we so quickly forget all the things that he has done in the past? And there are some real reasons why that happens, and we need to be thinking all those through. And then Brother Friesen, when he was here in Psalm 61 or 2, where do we put our trust? Where's our faith, and where do we put our trust? And now today I'd like to look at this verse, Matthew chapter 16. Who do you say that I am? Now again, the purpose for all of this, again, let me just say it one more time, is not to, you know, use this pulpit as a club to bully you. But I think these questions do deserve an answer. Jesus Christ asked them of his followers. I don't see any reason why they do not apply to us. And if we're able to answer them in a right way most of the time, then we see just the richness and the fullness of the abundant life that John 10:10, that Jesus Christ offers for us. So now as we're trying to find our pages back there in Matthew chapter 16, the question for us today is, who do men say that I am? Now, as I mentioned, next week will be Father's Day, so it'll be a purely evangelistic sermon. So if you can get some family, relatives, or neighbors, I would encourage you to bring them. During that time, Father's Day, we will also do what we did with Mother's, but I'll give you a little bit more advance notice. We'll give you some times for testimonies so that you can thank God for the lessons your father taught you. Maybe he taught you a good work ethic. Maybe he taught you to be honest. Maybe he taught you, the importance of the family name. You know, son, when you walk out of here and when you go somewhere or you pick up that girl or whatever, don't forget who you are. Or maybe he taught you the values of, education or family or helping others or many other things. If your father was a believer, you can have an opportunity to thank God for the lessons that your father taught you spiritually, from the basics of who God is and all the questions that children ask relating to God that we as fathers oftentimes have the privilege of answering. Lessons about the Bible, being a servant, prayer, victory, resisting the devil, putting on the armor of God, all kinds of stuff. So we'll give you that opportunity to do so at the beginning of our service. We're going to be looking at these verses here, 13 through 19. And it's a very important question. In fact, some might say it is the most important question ever asked in the Bible. And we'll show you maybe some reasons for that. So as we begin with the context of the questions, they're in Caesarea Philippi, verse 13, when Jesus came to the region of Caesarea Philippi. Jesus took the disciples to the Gentile territory. They're about 120 miles from Jerusalem, and they're in the northernmost part of Palestine. Caesarea Philippi was located about 25 miles south or northeast of the Sea of Galilee, about 40 miles west of Damascus. They're on a beautiful plateau, probably at the headwaters of the Jordan River. So it would be like some of you that maybe like to get away in the mountains on the summer day of all the oppressive heat down below. Then you get up above and you go, oh, this is refreshing. Well, it's very refreshing there. I've never had the privilege of being at the headwaters of the Jordan River, but I've been at the headwaters of the Mississippi up there in Itasca State Park. And the headwaters of the Mississippi is probably not much wider than this room is this way, and you can walk on stones or just about go barefoot across the mighty Mississippi. Can't quite do that down there in Louisiana. So anyway, it's a very idyllic place. If they were to look a few miles to the north, they would probably see that snow-capped Mount Hermon, about elevation of about 9,000 or so feet above sea level. Maybe on a very clear day, they could see the mountains of the northern Galilean cities such as Capernaum, Cana, Nazareth. Being on the northernmost part of that Israel property, it was probably it's one of the last outposts of Judaism, shall we say. It was very susceptible to the pagan influence. Being 120 miles away from Jerusalem, it probably provided Jesus a little respite, getting away from those Sadducees and Pharisees and all those people that were ragging on him. So it gave him maybe a little bit of relief from the pressure of the Jewish leaders. And the timing of the question. Luke tells us in chapter 9, verse 18, we're not going to go there, that he posed this all-important question after praying alone. And Mark 8:27 points out they had not yet arrived in this city of Caesarea Philippi, but they were coming into it, and they were going through some of the outskirts of town. The spiritual setting for the question, again, being not in the hub of Jerusalem, where Judaism ruled and reigned supreme, of being out in the fringes of Judaism. There's various religions, and they're making their inroads into the area. It had been a center for Baal worship. The pagan god Pan, his shrine was there. Herod the Great had built a temple to honor Augustus Caesar. It was in the midst of all this Roman pantheism and the Baal worship that Jesus then asks this question, who am I? The question that Jesus asked, and this is where we want to spend just a few moments at, it's a very general question. In verse 13, Jesus looks at the disciples and he says, who do people say that I am? Now, think about that. Why would he ask such a question to the disciples? The second question, we can understand that, but why would he ask the first question? And there's many reasons for that. But I think there's also an assumption here. And the assumption is that they had been interacting with the culture. They'd been following around Jesus. They've been having their ear to the ground, so to speak. They've been listening and communicating with people. They were not necessarily locked up in their ivory palaces away from the people. They were not going to isolate them or cloister themselves or put themselves up in some monastery and keep themselves separate from the people. They were engaged with the people. And Jesus knew, they knew what people were saying. So when he asked the men, who do people say that I am? It wasn't kind of one of these goofy questions that didn't have an answer. He knew that they were interacting with them. Now, if we were to ask today, who do people say that Jesus is? We have some ways that we can gather that information. Doesn't take too many newspapers to figure out who people think God is. Doesn't take many news broadcasts. Doesn't take much coming out of Hollywood to kind of figure out who God is. The books, the articles, etc., etc. It doesn't take too many lectures in a public university to figure out who people think God is. But let's bring it a little bit closer to you and I. If Jesus came up to you, here we'll pick on Brother Jesse. So if Jesus was to come up to Pastor Jesse and say, Brother Jesse, who do people say that I am? Now, within his sphere of circle, his sphere of influence, there you go, his sphere of influence, his circle of influence, do we know what people think about Jesus Christ? So if I were to come to Pastor Jesse and I said, Pastor Jesse, who do your neighbors think Christ is? What would be the answer? If we were to go to Pastor Jesse and say, now your co-workers, who do people think Christ is? If they were to go to the family members, your nieces, your nephews, you know, all these guys are going to get together the 4th of July, you know, we got this big family shindig, and some of you are going, yahoo, and some of you are going, oh boy, not again. We just went through that with Memorial Day. We got to do it again for 4th of July. Well, yes, and here's another opportunity for you to find out who do all these in-laws and outlaws think Jesus is. But here's one of the key points that sometimes we kind of skip the first question and go to the second question. But the first question is, if Jesus were to come to you and say, who do your co-workers, your neighbors, your family members say the Son of Man is, could you give an answer? Have you interacted with them? Have you engaged them? Do you know, let's even make it a little bit broader, do you know the religion or the churches that your immediate neighbors go to? Like Methodist or Presbyterian or Roman Catholic or like right around you, just your immediate neighborhood, you know, front, back, left, right, across the street. Let's even make it very broader. Where do they go to church, if at all? Because we got one that doesn't even go to church. But who do men say that Christ is? And that's a question that you and I need to be wrestling with. Do we know what our neighbors, our co-workers, our friends, our family, who are they saying Christ is? And we need to pause on that. The disciples knew the answer. The disciples absolutely knew the answer. Well, some people say you're John the Baptist. Some of you say that you're Elijah. Some of you say you're Jeremiah. Some of you say you're some of the other prophets. They knew what people were saying. And I think there's a lesson here for you and I that we need to really begin to get out into the highways and byways and ask people, who do you say Christ is? Who is this Jesus Christ? But then he comes to a more personal question. And he comes to the personal question there in verse 15, and he says, okay, now I'm not so curious about what your neighbors or your co-workers or your friends or family, but Now, who do you say that I am? And again, this is a very critical question. This is probably one of the ultimate questions that every single human being will answer, because on it hinges the eternal destiny of every single soul. If many people would say, well, he was a moral teacher, then that answer is going to put them in a very miserable eternal condition. If they would say, he is the Christ, he is the Son of God, well, then that's going to put them in a more pleasant eternal predicament. So every soul, as it were, is going to be pinned against the wall of eternity and forced to answer that question, who do you say that I am? The answer to the question comes there in verses 15 through 16. Peter got it right. Peter's the spokesman. Peter's the one that, you know, was, I don't remember what commentator said, but he has the impression of his foot on his mouth because he's always putting his foot into it. But he got this one right. You know, the brash, bolsterous Peter, he says, thou art the Christ, the Son of the living God. And that is a good answer. And it's also kind of interesting that from this question, Jesus said, blessed are you, Simon Bar-Jonah, for flesh and blood has not revealed this to you, but my Father who is in heaven. So, Peter's answer, you are the Christ, you are the Son of the living God. At last now, the Trinity it's gelled. It's fixed. They now know who this man is. You know, as we've seen them earlier on in their ministry, as they're following Jesus Christ, they're vacillating, going back and forth, and they're so surprised that, wow, even the winds and the waves obey him. But now it's all clicking. You know, we use the idea of connecting all the dots. Well, they're starting to connect all the dots, and it's all coming together, and the picture's coming clear, and they say, you now are the Christ. But it's also interesting that this Holy Spirit has had a role in this. And this is why, again, and I want to pause just for a minute, when you and I get together and we start talking to our neighbors and our coworkers and our friends and our family and those that we rub shoulders with on a semi-regular basis, the guys we go bowling with or fishing with, we need to be praying. Because, again, we know that it is the Holy Spirit that needs to quicken us and make us alive.